Before we get all the way into this, let me just tell you one quick thing about our own decision-making process, which is we'd planned this show about polling, and then obviously we went through several days of national trauma about first the pipe bomb perpetrator and then, of course, the Tree of Life tragedy. And we really did discuss over the weekend, maybe, because we're pretty comfortable, particularly with our Monday show, changing plans if circumstances dictate. But A, we discovered our colleagues at Where We Live. We're going to do a very good, very interesting show this morning. And also, in B, you know, there is... First of all, there's something to be said for the philosophy in times of trauma and tragedy. And there are places all over the world where, at least anecdotally, this is the case. That, you know, sometimes you just learn to sweep up the glass and set up the cafe tables and get back on with life so that the people who do these kinds of things don't rule our behavior all the time. And there was a little of that in my soul this weekend. And also, one of the things I do believe about the pipe bomb alleged perpetrator and the Tree of Life alleged perpetrator is these are people who ultimately departed from the world of fact. They began to believe things that were not true. Their information environment turned into, or they turned to, an information environment that was detached from reality. And so it's really important to sort of think about truth and reality. And in that sense, the show that we're doing right now is, I think, right on point, because this is a whole world of information that we navigate all the time. And we don't always navigate it as brilliantly as we could. So the more you know about it, the better off you are. We're going to try to clarify a bunch of things for you today. We've done this in the past. When we do it, we usually do it with Jennifer Dineen, program director of the graduate program in survey research at the UConn Department of Public Policy. Joining us a little bit later will be Mallory Newell, public polling research director for Ipsos Public Affairs. As we go along here, too, I mean, we'll welcome your questions. I am convinced that I know the answers to all kinds of questions about polling. That's probably not true, but Jennifer probably does. So there you go. And our number is 860-275-7266. I'll say one more thing, which is that we're all forecasters. All the time, you're forecasting, right? You buy a car, you're basically a forecaster. You're gathering up some information, trying to find out some predictive information about the car. Is it going to be a good car? Is it going to have problems? Is it worth what you're paying for it? You do that when you get married. You do that like with all kinds of stuff. You try to forecast. So there's forecasting, which we do all the time. And it's one of the reasons that we like polls, too. I mean, as Homo sapiens, we're kind of wired to want to know about the future. But polls also tell us a lot about the present. And Jennifer and I, we're going to begin by talking about that. Jennifer, I think our prejudice is to think about polls that tell us how an election is going to turn out. But first of all, that's only one of many things that polls attempt to do. And it might be the most rickety of the structures for polling, right? Polling can also tell us just a lot about what's going on right at the present moment.
Absolutely. Election polling is one small, tiny slice of all of the polling that gets done. And it's definitely the most challenging and least dependable. And the job of polls during an election is to tell us what's going on in the election and what it looks like at a particular time. They're not actually predictive. They're informative.
Right. So we should say polling goes on all the time, and there's polling on everything from do you believe in climate change to do you believe in ghosts. There's polling about, you know, well, do you think this tax cut that was just passed is going to help you? So these are all kinds of questions that people can answer those questions. We were just talking about this in the green room before without, in fact, trying to predict their own behavior, right? They're just answering a question.
Right. I mean, a lot of the polling that gets done might even be about how a particular tax cut or policy change has had an impact on people to assess whether or not it's working.
Right. And then beyond that, all of that kind of polling, as is the case with all kinds of election polling, is full of what we sometimes call crosstabs. So these are like, how does this question work? This tax cut question work if you're college educated or not, or
right,
white
if you're
or
low income or not, or if you have a large family or not. Absolutely.
So, but for some reason or other, even though we're aware of all those polls and we're aware of polls about the approval rating of various professions, including journalism, which tends to have a very low Gallup approval rating.
As do pollsters.
So for some reason or other, the rock stars, the superstars of polls tend to be elections, probably because it's something where we really want to know how it's going to come out. So the first question I would have is how good should we think polls are at telling us something like that?
not. Mm. So you're right. We can't help ourselves. Mm. Even those of us who know better can't help ourselves. And elections are something, they're long, they're races, they're competitive. We're looking for sort of a score in the game, I think, as they progress. And polls are numbers, and people tend to see numbers as being hard and fast when, you know, actually there's a lot behind them. And there's a lot of flexibility in those numbers, too.
And so I think the other thing that's happened is that, first of all, we have a very information-rich environment right now. If you're interested in these things or even mildly interested in these things, you have – I mean, you know, I grew up in a time where there was sort of, you know, a newspaper and some, you know, evening news, and you can get Time magazine in the mail or something. And so, I mean, that's what I kind of knew about polls, too. Now, there's a sense in which the information environment changes all the time, and if you want to know more about it, you can know more about it. You might not know better about it, but you can know more about it all the time.
Absolutely, and it comes in fast and furious. I mean, especially the week leading up to the election, it was, you know, you can refresh your browser perpetually and constantly be getting new information. And polling has gotten quicker as we do more and more of it on the web, and so we are now getting more of it more often.
So as we go along here, by the way, we will take your questions. We're going to leave the third and final section completely open so you can call in with questions. I mean, at least we have another agenda if you don't call in. But 860-275-7266. So one of the things that I encounter, you encounter it more, I'm sure, is when we talk about polling, when we talk about electoral polling, people say, well, they got it so wrong in 2016. They had no idea. They didn't have a handle on what was going on. So why should I pay any attention in 2018, maybe sort of, flesh out people's understanding a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I would take some issue with the sentiment that polls got it completely wrong in 2016. They certainly weren't perfect, and there were some issues. Nationally, the polls did pretty well. I think they predicted that Clinton would win by about 3, and she was ahead in the popular vote by about 2%. So that's not that off. There were definitely some issues with statewide polls. Some of that was because of a late movement towards Trump. And polling, especially in the states, does not happen as frequently. It does not happen as close to Election Day. And when you have a candidate where support is what I call soft, which is that you have a lot of people who support the candidate but maybe not enthusiastically, that firming of opinion doesn't happen until very close to the vote for those people. So that was one issue. The other issue is because of a lack of statewide polling and polling in certain districts, we have a lot of people entering the arena using sort of DIY tools and they have less methodology, they have less funding, they're doing the polls quicker, and so they're producing a lower quality product, which is coming into play with the aggregators and you know, playing with the estimates and the confidence a little bit.
Right. And if that was at all confusing to you, we're going to explain all of that in just a second. But so one of the things, like, as I go back and I think, okay, what didn't I know? What, because I mean, I feel like I was a journalist reporting on this, and B, I was teaching it at Trinity. And I said to my students the day after the election, go to the bursar's office, see if you can get your money back. I clearly don't know what I'm talking about. But so one of the things that I think about, and what's one of the reasons I'm interested in this, the project that we'll be looking at in the second segment with Ipsos, where they're trying to use social media a little bit to kind of get a different kind of handle on what's happening, is I think about the thing that I think I most didn't understand, if that makes any sense. And it's actually an idea that I had invented for myself back in 2008, and I called it the Palin ceiling. And what the Palin ceiling was the number of voters, the percentage of voters who could not, under any circumstances, be persuaded to vote for Sarah Palin. That there was some rock-hard number there, and that it almost didn't make any difference what happened over on the other side. They just couldn't do it. I used it also with Linda McMahon. I felt like there was a sort of drop-dead number in her Senate races here in Connecticut where you just couldn't do it. Now, what I didn't think about, and if I don't know if it was there in the polls and I didn't see it or I didn't think to look at it, I think that there was a similar number for Hillary Clinton. There was some kind of ceiling where no matter what people found, certain people, no matter what they found out about Donald Trump, you know, taped, you know, declarations of his sexual behavior, whatever, you know, dissing John McCain. It didn't matter. They couldn't be tipped into the Clinton column. I feel like, you know, there's often a missing piece of information. It might be there in the polls, but the polls, because they're vast and have cross tabs and stuff like that, sometimes we just miss the thing that we should have been thinking about.
I think, yeah. So I think that I agree. There are two things I see coming into play here. One, I agree with that view of the ceiling, and I use similar ones. And also, I think there's two things. One, election polls are trying to figure out who votes. Mm-hmm. And so unlike other polling, we actually don't know who the population is that we are trying to assess or predict. And we are using questions about interest in the election and knowledge and candidate support to figure out who our pool of voters are. And that pool changes from election to election. Mm-hmm. So the ceiling for Linda McMahon and the ceiling for Hillary Clinton and the ceiling for Sarah Palin, there were ceilings.
Mm-hmm.
But what one election tells us doesn't necessarily show us where the ceiling is in the future.
Oh, yeah. And first of all, you're talking about completely different voter bases. We're talking about McMahon versus Clinton.
Right.
But the first thing, as you're saying, the first thing you got to do is figure out, well, who the hell actually is going to show up on that particular day and cast any vote at all.
Right. So that is the big challenge and what makes pre-election polling so hard. The other thing I think comes into play, and certainly does, is we underestimate the strength of partisanship. And academically, we know that. Political scientists who study party registration and party identification know that it is the single biggest predictor of vote. Mm-hmm. And I think that there was a narrative going on where people could not get to the point where they could accept that things like taped behaviors of exploits would not trump party identification.
So to speak.
And so I think that was another part of our challenge there.
It is interesting. Sometimes what you pick up anecdotally, you can at least put it side by side with the data you're looking at and say, oh, yeah, I wonder if the fact that, you know, 10 people in a bar said that they didn't care, nothing could ever get them to vote for Hillary Clinton. I wonder if that's, you know, important in terms of that. You know, as long as you're talking about party affiliation, I was going to bring this up later, but it's something that I've been thinking a lot about recently. So we live in Connecticut. And in Connecticut, since 1998 at least, unaffiliated voters have been a larger number than voters from either major party. I think around 98, they got up over 40%, and I think they've never gone below that. But I think the mistake we sometimes make in political journalism is thinking of them as some kind of unit, which they're not. So, and Pew is the only group I know that's looked at lean. So, you know, within that 800,000 or 900,000 person group, there's all kinds of things. There's some people who almost always vote with the Democrats, people who almost always vote with the Republicans. You know, it seems to me that that's one thing that we could maybe learn to be a little bit more subtle about, is that question of lean among unaffiliated.
Absolutely. So Connecticut it's about 41% as of the 2017 numbers of unaffiliated voters. Nationally, we have about 28% identifying as independent. And we do talk about those people as they truly are neutral. Mm-hmm. And many of them are not. Many of them do behave more like partisans. They just don't choose to identify with that. What we're seeing nationally, which I think is really interesting, is that there's not clear consensus among voters who identify themselves as independent on what the most important issues are.
Mm-hmm.
So Democrats are talking a lot about health care.
Yeah.
Republicans are talking a lot about the economy and immigration nationally. I've looked at a couple of different polls. Independents, or voters who call themselves independents, are split on those issues.
As long as we're on this, one of the things that we're trying to do right now, under quite a bit of pressure in the world of political journalism in Connecticut, is to figure out what a candidacy like Oz Griebel's means. And there, I should say, there's a Quinnipiac poll in the field right now. We should have some new numbers probably Wednesday, something like that. They won't tell us, but something like that. It's a hard thing. It's a tough thing to do. I mean, one nice thing about we should also say this. We're going to get into a little bit of geekiness. But for me, an individual poll is almost useless. A poll where I can draw a trend line from two polls using the exact same methodology, so a Q poll of likely voters to a Q poll of likely voters, I'm much more interested in that, so
absolutely,
I can see a trend. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, and one of the things I will often counsel people is not to take a single data point for being worth too much information. You know, you want to see the trend line. You want to see the trend line from the same organization, and you also want to be able to benchmark that information among what other organizations are doing.
Mm-hmm.
In a state like Connecticut, that's challenging because there's so little polling going on.
Yeah.
Here.
And so with something like the Griebel candidacy, I mean, the question is, does he pull from one side more from the other? And we can look at that. I don't know, as somebody who does this in a much more scientific way than I do, is there a way to get a handle on that?
Well, there is a way to get a handle on that. I haven't seen Quinnipiac ask, and I don't know if they will, who else a voter might support if Griebel wasn't in the race.
I don't think they're asking that question.
I didn't see it on the last poll, and so I don't know if it's on this one. And so you could look at that. You can also look at how certain they are. What I did see in the last poll was 2/3 of the Griebel voters were unsure, said they might change their mind. Yeah. And so if he in the last poll was polling at about 11%, I think, only about 30% of that was really strong and sure. So I don't know. I know he did pick up the current endorsement. I don't know how much that will change, but those are the sorts of indicators that I would look for.
You know, you talked about a lot of people getting into the game. Not all polls are created equal. They don't have the same quality. This is something you and I have talked about in the past, and I think I emailed you my thing about how a poll is like a chicken. That, you know, like ultimately, you want to ask a lot of questions about that chicken.
Right.
Is it farm-raised? Did it have any antibiotics? Is it, you know, and it's the same thing about a poll. Just saying poll is like saying chicken. It doesn't really tell you that much. So one thing that that happens in some places, for example, at 538, they now have a poll rating system. You can go and you can look at it. It tells you what their lean is. In other words, if they make a mistake, they'll probably make it this way. They tell you how accurate this poll is. They assign it a letter grade. I mean, that's sort of a lot of work for the average person to go through. Are there things that you could just tell the average person, well, at least look for this, look for these things?
There are, but that is getting harder and harder. I used to be able to give you five quick quick points. I mean, obviously, we always look at the organization, who does the poll, who's paying for it, and do they have a stake in the outcome, right? Is it a candidate or an organization that might have some interest in putting out numbers other than just a really accurate prediction? We're going to look at the sample size and the margin of error. Polls get reported as a single estimate. And by that, I mean a single percentage, 49%, let's say. But really what they are is a range. And that's where we hear a lot of talk and we see the margin of error. That means that if a poll has a margin of error, and this is I'm getting geeky for you. So if a poll has a margin of error of plus or minus 3% and they predict that a candidate is going to get 49% of the vote, that really means that it's going to be somewhere between 46% and 52%.
Right.
And so it's not as precise an estimate as it might see. So you want to make sure that it's not a really small sample size. Only a couple hundred. And then you're looking at...
The thousand is often, like at least in national polls, I see that as like a target number for a lot of people.
In national polls, between, I'd say, 900 and 1,200 is pretty much the standard. Statewide, you're likely to see in a state like Connecticut, 500 to 600 sometimes. And you're also looking to see how transparent a pollster is about their methodology. Did they tell you what their sample was? Did they tell you how they contacted their voter by web? The less information there is about how they did their study, the more suspect I usually am.
Right. Likely voter screen, important to you?
Yes. And likely voter screen is important at different times. So if we backed up 3 months ago, you wouldn't be talking about likely voters because 3 months, especially in a midterm election, nobody's really thought about it a lot. You'd be looking at general population or registered voters. But now,
you can still ask them predictive questions. Did they vote in the last election? Do they know? Do they know where their polling place is? Do they know, you know, stuff like that?
Yeah. And that really changes organization to organization.
Right.
It can be 7 or 8 questions. It can be 3 questions.
Right.
Are they interested in the race? Do they plan on voting? And do they know who they're going to vote for? The tighter the likely voter screen, the more problematic it can be sometimes, especially in a race like this one where they're anticipating, you know, the Taylor Swift effect, right? Young people are supposedly expected to turn out at a higher rate than they have in previous midterms.
Right. So we should say one more thing. When you're talking about the margin for error, I have to bring up one of my current pet peeves about my own profession. And then we'll grab a break. We'll come back with more Jennifer, and we're going to add Ipsos to the conversation. So as Jennifer knows, I feel as though journalists are kind of bad at this. And many journalists just don't understand polling, or they just don't want to understand polling. And so, I mean, they make really, you know, obvious, easy to fix errors. And the latest one that I'm noticing a lot of people doing is the phrase dead heat. So, I mean, if Ned Lamont is up 3% in a poll that, and this is a real example too, he's up 3% in a poll that has a 4% margin for error. I've seen both the Hartford Current and the Hearst papers have said, so it's a dead heat. Well, it's not a dead heat. I mean, it might be a dead heat, but that's one end of the range. You're assuming that the reversion goes in a certain direction. I mean, Ned Lamont could be 7% or 8% up, you know. I mean, but they just sort of pick the thing that makes a headline or something.
Well, right. So it's not really a tie at that point, because the margin of error applies to each candidate. So
right.
Ned Lamont could be up
7 points.
7 points. Yeah. And so, yes, there is not necessarily a statistical tie. We just can't make a call based on the information we have.
Right. Now, I almost asked you this in the green room. I'm going to ask you now, because I thought about today and I realized I think I know the answer to this, but maybe I don't. When we talk about it, when we're talking about a margin for error. So let's say that Dineen is ahead of McEnroe by 4 points, and there's a margin of error of 5 points. Then we imagine a continuum, and the continuum is you might be ahead of me by 9 points, or you might be
behind
me by 1 point. Is every point on that continuum from -1 to 9 of equal probability? I mean, if there's a margin for error, there isn't, like, the middle isn't worth more than the extremes, right?
No. Okay. No, we're really predicting what we call an interval. So
right.
That the real value is somewhere in that 6-point swing.
Yeah.
And we have picked the midpoint to repeat.
All right. That was a really geeky question, but I suddenly wanted to know the answer. Okay, so we're going to take a break, and there's some really interesting new things that are being tried this time. We're going to talk to somebody from Ipsos, that's one of the places where they're trying them. We'll also talk a little bit about what Upshot is doing. Upshot kind of lives inside the New York Times and is doing an experiment in transparency that the likes of which I think has not been seen before in polling. So more of Jennifer Dineen, and you'll meet Mallory Newell.
Dear old Union League they love so well. Stand the pollsters all assembled, with their spirits not so high, and the music of their weeping casts a spell. Yes, the music of their weeping.
All right, we are back. Now, we're going to tell you about some new things going on in polling, and then if you have some questions, particularly here in this complicated midterm season, we'll open the phones to you for that. Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. I'm here with Jennifer Dineen, Program Director for the Graduate Program in Survey Research at UConn Department of Public Policy. Also joining us by phone now is Mallory Newell, Public Polling – boy, there's so many P's in these introductions – Public Polling Research Director of Ipsos Public Affairs. Mallory Newell, welcome to our conversation.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. So Ipsos is trying something new in a partnership. It's called Atlas. Tell us about Atlas.
Yes, that's right. So what Ipsos has done is we've partnered with the University of Virginia Center for Politics to create a website called the Political Atlas. And basically, it's a one-stop shop for looking at contested races across the country at all levels, House, the Senate, and gubernatorial races. So what we've done here with the Political Atlas is we've taken a sort of triangulated approach to data analysis. And what I mean by that is here in this website, we have a number of different indicators, from polling data to the UVA expert race rankings, their crystal ball rankings they're called, as well as social media analytics. And we've brought all of these together so that people can explore the site. It's very interactive, and sort of reach their own conclusions about what's going to happen next week.
All right. So the term social media analytics is one that we probably wouldn't have even been using in a conversation about polling even just a few years ago. So explain what you mean by that.
Sure, and I think you're totally right. This is something that's pretty new when it comes to how you analyze political races. So what we've done is we've looked at conversations happening across social media and categorized them into politically important issues. So one of the things that we do on the Political Atlas when it comes to social media is we look at the main issues that people are talking about on social media across a number of different platforms. So it's everything from President Trump to the Supreme Court, healthcare, the economy, things like that. But we're also using social media to track the sentiment about candidates in a specific race. So we measure, for example, in the governor's race in Connecticut, the percentage of conversations that are favorable toward Ned Lamont, for example.
Right. And believe me, I've been looking at that right now. I'm going to have Jennifer. I'm sure she's got some questions that she would like to ask you. So do you have some things that you want to know or comment about or I mean, as she's thinking about that, let me just ask you one. So when you say, I mean, it seems to me to measure the tone of a conversation, which is so different from asking set questions from people that you're sampling. In other words, you don't have a chance to go on Reddit and ask them an explicitly worded question about why they're calling Ned Lamont a jerk or something like that. So how do you measure that thing, just as a positive versus a negative?
Yes, it's basically measuring sentiments of the conversation. And in terms of the key issues, we measure, the amount of conversation that's about that given issue. But I think what's more important is that the reason behind why we're doing this, right? Mm-hmm. So this is something that came out of basically a lesson learned from 2016, which is something that we talk about a lot as pollsters. And I think the Political Atlas was sort of born out of this idea that there's no single approach or single factor for predicting an election. 2016, the conversation was focused on just a single method of forecasting, and that was relying heavily on polling and public opinion models, right? So what the Atlas does is it was sort of created out of this desire for bringing multiple independent indicators, social media being one of them, together so people can sort of, again, reach their own conclusions and look at all of these sources in one spot.
Right. This is what I call, by the way, in my own little eccentric universe, the Noelke effect. So there's this guy named John Noelke here in Connecticut. And what he does is he, like during 2016, every person he encountered, no matter what the environment, standing in line at the bakery, somebody who came to fix his furnace, whatever, he just said to them, what do you think about this election? And then he wrote down what they said, and he sent me emails that were compilations of these things. He sent me, I think, 33 emails that had in them, you know, 5 to 7 conversations each time or something. And when I went back and I looked at that, I thought, if I just read all of John Noelke's emails really carefully and then crunched it as like a 15% factor into what I knew about this election, I would have done a lot better. I would have understood better what's going on. But Jennifer, it seems to me the risk here, I mean, it does feel as though, I mean, you can't control sample size very well and things like that. I mean, what as a data scientist, what concerns would you have?
Well, I don't know if I have. I guess where I'm particularly interested, one of the great things I think about what's happening at the Political Atlas is that you're polling in places that have not seen polling in
right.
their congressional races before. So I guess I'm interested in what made you decide to do this rather than just do the contested races that, you know, the very close races that everybody else is doing? And are there challenges as a pollster to doing that?
Sure. That's a great question. So Ipsos has a partnership with Reuters where we are constantly polling nationwide daily tracking on just the pulse of the country and where people are at. And from there, that feeds into our election prediction model that we use on the Political Atlas to look at some of these different places and smaller geographies. I think, too, one of the reasons why it's important to not just look at so-called contested races is because that list is constantly changing and constantly growing. I think personally, one of the things that's most interesting about the 2018 midterms is that there are some House races that are on the map as toss-up districts for the first time ever, right? And we're also seeing a ton of first-time candidates coming into the mix and, you know, raising a huge amount of money, something that you can also find on the Political Atlas, actually, is fundraising data. So I think one of the reasons why it's best to look at everything altogether rather than limiting to a specific geography is because you know, the map is changing. And part of this election is, you know, we saw a lot of uncertainty coming out of the president's election in 2016. And this age of uncertainty is no different this year, right? So I think it's really important to not limit ourselves where we're looking at, and to understand how people across the country are thinking, rather than in just, say, 23 districts or, you know, 12 states.
So, Mallory, I had one more question about the social media stuff, because I was on the Atlas site today, and it is great. And Jennifer was saying before we went on the air, there's just a lot of races where there's almost no polling, you know, across the country. There are these, you know, high marquee races, and so it is great to get that information. It seemed as though the social media stuff, I would go on a drop-down menu and click on social media, and then I would get that particular take. Is the social media also crunched into any overall total, or is it always just sort of there only as the social media piece?
It's there only as its social media piece. And the reason for that, like I mentioned before, is that we want to have these three independent indicators. So our polling estimates, social media, and then UVA's ratings separate from each other. So you can say if you go to the Atlas and you look at the Connecticut governor's race, you have three indicators at the top, right, telling you here's what, according to the polling, the race looks like. According to UVA, here's what it looks like. And finally, according to social media, here's what it says. And the reason for that is when we have these three independent indicators, we want to leave them separately but present all of them together, because one of the things that I think we've really learned coming out of 2016 is the need for greater transparency when it comes to polling. And you really need to present all of your indicators to the public to really accurately convey the full picture of what we're seeing.
I would totally agree with that, Mallory, although I would encourage Ipsos to translate its how to calculate Bayesian credibility intervals segments on those Reuters polls into English that the average person can understand. But it's good that you do that anyway. You can ask a question.
I do have one more question. Yeah. So I was looking at the Connecticut races, and I noticed, you know, that all of the different indicators point in the same direction, which is something that I like to look at. Do all of the different ways we can look at an election or a race look the same? But I did notice that the social ratings were slightly weaker, slightly less strong in the point towards the Democratic wins at the congressional levels than, let's say, the polling. Is there an overall trend nationally on how social and your polling is tracking? Does that vary a lot state to state?
It's a great question. If people, just to make sure people understood it, so we're asking, Ipsos is doing this unusual thing where they're really looking at social media, trying to quantify what's coming out of social media. So Jennifer's asking, well, so does it map pretty closely, or does it track pretty closely with the way conventional polling, or does it seem to have a different kind of lean? What's the answer, Mallory?
Social media doesn't really lean one way or the other. I think that's one of the more interesting things about it, because it's one of the few indicators that's really telling us what the conversations are like on the ground. And so what we see with our social media is that there are more races nationwide that fall into that middle toss-up category, which I think speaks to the fact that the map and the number of toss-ups that, you know, we have right now for the midterms is larger than it's ever been.
Right. I just realized that I reworded Jennifer's question, but I didn't do any better than she did at wording it. That was really bad mansplaining. I would like to withdraw that. All right. Well, listen, this stuff is really fascinating, and we really encourage people to go over to this Atlas project between UVA and Ipsos. It's been really, really interesting to look at. And if you like playing around with this stuff and messing around with drop-down menus and stuff like that, if you're that kind of person, you're going to have a really good time there. Thanks very much to Mallory Newell, a public polling research director for Ipsos Public Affairs. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
When we come back, Jennifer and I are going to talk about something else that The Upshot's doing. Mallory mentioned transparency. The Upshot, which lives at the New York Times, is doing some really unusually transparent stuff about how polling works.
If we all join hands, there's a mountain of trouble. You're just one man. We can move that mountain if we all join hands. Well, you can vote early, but you can't vote late. Your rules will vary from state to state. You can vote early, but you can't vote late. The rules will vary from state.
All right. Usually Wolfie does the credits here, but I forgot to write the script. We both forgot about it. So I'm excited to say that Scott Breedy, who is the regular producer of The Wheelhouse, is producing his first Colin McEnroe Show episode ever today. He's going to be doing that more, as well as doing episodes occasionally of Where We Live. So congratulations to Scott. Jennifer and I are trying hard not to screw up your first episode. Betsy
so
Kaplan.
Much pressure now.
Yeah, that's right. Betsy Kaplan, who's senior producer of The Colin McEnroe Show, is on the phones now. You've got a chance to talk to Betsy Kaplan, if you call 860-275-7266. She doesn't suffer fools gladly, but I'm sure she'll enjoy your question. If you want to ask a question about polls, if there's something you'd like to have Jennifer Dineen clear up for you in the world of opinion research, data science, 860-275-7266. And then you also get a brush with greatness. You get to talk to Betsy Kaplan. Kyone Wolf, obviously, is helping out all that great music. People ask me, where does the music come from? Kyone Wolf picks out, I'd say, 92% of the music that we use in and out of segments. Does lots of other magical things instead. Who else do I need to thank? That's about it. The part of Bill Curry was played by Nate Silver. Tomorrow on the show, I've already... it's the show about explorers. We're doing the show about explorers. And I want to mention Wednesday. So there's a group of people who don't turn up in opinion research. They don't turn up in a lot of places. They are non-traditional political candidates. We sometimes call them fringe candidates. They don't always like that. But anyway, we try to invite them in here because they don't get, and particularly the people who are running as like registered write-in candidates and stuff like that. I mean, nobody ever covers them. So we're inviting them not all of them. There's a lot of them, but we'll be talking to quite a few of them on Wednesday, as we typically do. All right. Get to know your fringe candidates. All right. We're back with Jennifer Dineen. I want to begin. I said the thing about the upshot. So the upshot's doing kind of two things, maybe more than two things. But let's start with the first one. They're showing you a poll not as a finished product, but as it's building up to being a finished product, right?
Absolutely. They're calling it live polling. So they're showing you how many phone calls they're making and how many completes they get with different segments of the population and what the percentages look like as the survey is in process.
Right. And so you can also, you can look at it on the site, each poll. So you go to some Pennsylvania race or New York race that you're interested in. And what you see is this kind of steep error curve at the beginning. So you see these kind of outlying data points that are just way too high or way too low. And then it starts to revert to the mean. It starts to go more towards the middle. So if you're like us, that's kind of exciting to look at. I don't know that it's really all that exciting, but for me, I'm like, wow, that's really cool. You can actually see, you know, them getting towards reality there.
Yes, you can see the math in progress. I think so. That's interesting, and I applaud the upshot for trying to increase the transparency of polling and demystify it for people. I think in an effort to increase public trust and confidence again. Mm-hmm. It's also a little bit, for those of us who poll, I find it a little bit nerve-wracking because you may look at this and get excited and know that these numbers are going to change and that the error margin is going to decrease. But sometimes we're seeing these partial numbers reported out from their site. So we're seeing numbers based on 150, 200 interviews making their way into the narrative of what polling is like on this election.
Well, there's two very dangerous groups to put this information in the hands of. I think the most dangerous group are people who are affiliated with candidates because they're going to go, oh, we're 17 points up. Well, now you're 17 points up. It's one half of day one of a four-day poll or something.
You have a 20-point margin of error. You're no points up.
Right. You're no points up. And then I think journalists, as we said, they don't always understand polling. So they look at something and go, wow, look at this, you know, and then they
200
tweet
people.
Yeah. So, but it's still, I mean, if you could sort of get past that, and don't do that, by the way, just don't do that. You're wrecking it. So the other thing that I'm fascinated by is, and maybe other people have done this, but in plain English, and I think that's really important too, the upshot is explaining how they calculate turnout and what the different possible ways they could correct for who's actually going to turn out and vote. That was the original question you brought up, Jennifer. And also whether they're oversampling a kind of person who's not going to vote.
Right. So that is really interesting. And so they are showing what the election predictions look like, or the picture of the race, depending on how you want to frame it, under different scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know who's going to turn out. And so we make some assumptions about people's past behavior and the history of voting in that district, and they show you what the data looks like under those different assumptions. They also show you what it looks like under different assumptions for what's called weighting. Mm-hmm. And weighting is some statistical adjusting we do to the sample after we've collected data to make up for the groups that don't respond. This was a really big issue in 2016 mm-hmm. because there was such a high correlation between level of education, whether or not someone had a college degree or more, and their vote preference. And so they're showing us what the data looks like under both of those scenarios.
Right. What they'll do, actually, on the upshot, is they'll show you slightly different outcomes depending on, you know, if they changed the way that they weighted. Like if they weighted by a different – if they didn't weight by education, for example, you know, well, then here's how it looked. If they ignored that as a factor, then here's how it comes out, you know, that kind of thing. So – and I mean, it's probably a relatively easy thing for them to do. They're just like, you know, tweaking a formula or an algorithm based on either having or not having a certain set of data. But it's very cool. It's very interesting to look at. It gives you a little bit more. I mean, the problem I think is if you have 8 different theories, you have no theory. Like you know.
There's that. Yeah. I mean, and I think it is cool if you get through their top lines and see that, you know, if you look at turnout like it happened in 2014 rather than 2016, you can get a very different result of your poll. And so I think that's interesting. I think if you don't understand all of the theory that's behind those different models, it can look a little bit like you're making it up.
Right. So I think we've got a caller here who knows you and perhaps is prepared to challenge you in a very specific way. Here's Fred from Storrs. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Colin. I wanted to comment on what's happening in the World Association for Public Opinion Research, an international organization. The president for the next 2 years, Marita Carvalho, plans to have a major outreach to journalists so that there'll be seminars for journalists to report on public opinion from countries all over the world to understand how public opinion works better.
I would like my seminar to be held in some really fascinating European capital, if possible.
Well, the WAPOR meetings are every other year in Europe or some other international location. On the other odd years, they're here in the United States.
So you want to comment on this?
Yes. Yeah. Hello, Professor Turner.
Hi.
Yes, this year the meeting is in Toronto, actually, and both WAPOR, the World Association for Public Opinion Research, and APOR, the American Association for Public Opinion Research, have as their, you know, part of their mission educating people and providing resources for journalists or the general public who's interested in understanding more about the different methodologies and the implications of those methods.
I mean, I think it's a great thing because, as I've been saying all along, and I'm sure, by the way, I am not as faultless as I mean, it's like Daniel Kahneman, you know, I've overestimated my own abilities here, but I think journalists are really bad at this. You know, I think we really do report things
but
the wrong way.
To be fair, it has gotten so complicated. Two or three election cycles ago, it was very simple. You were looking for live interview or telephone polls with random digit dial samples. And now there are so many different methodologies, and the speed of information is so much quicker, and the space journalists have to work on is so much smaller that, ironically, I'm going to make a plug that it's just gotten hard to be really competent in this topic. And media organizations no longer have and the same sort of dedicated resources that they used to have for polls.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's some basic things that we can do, including just, I mean, it really is. I'm teaching a political science class at Yale last year. I developed this post called How a Poll is Like a Chicken, and how you could just look at a poll and at least have some kind of sense, you know, what kind of methodology was used, how reliable is the poll. I mean, one of the ways that 538 ultimately evaluates polls is, I mean, if they have a lot of data points about whether they were right or wrong, you know, that's one way to look at it. And I just don't think journalists do that. I have seen polls that I know don't have good methodology and aren't reliable and haven't been reliable being reported just the way a Q poll would be reported. And I don't think that's good. Let me ask you about another thing. This is sort of a philosophical point. It's a little bit outside your specialty. But, you know, one of the ways that polls get used these days is to decide whether somebody should be participating in a debate. You have to hit a certain, you know, number. You have to be in double figures, whatever, to be eligible for a debate. You know, when you and I have talked in the past, you've talked about how a poll is a snapshot. It's a snapshot of a particular moment. And that raises questions to me about whether that's a good use of a poll to say, well, on October, you know, on September 22nd, right, you know, you weren't doing so well.
Right. Well, and I think that's interesting. During the Republican primary leading up to the 2016 election, Marist College actually stopped releasing their pre-election numbers at a certain point because they did not want to contribute to that conversation. I don't know necessarily how we decide in races where we have a lot of candidates, because I don't think fundraising is necessarily fair or party endorsement. But your point that what the race looks like early on is not what the race is going to look like later. And if we only give the free media or access for the public to the people who are ahead, we're sort of perpetuating institutionalized candidates.
Yeah. It seems to me that a poll attempts to be a picture of how things are. It isn't necessarily intended to be a deciding point for how things should be. And also, of course, some polls aren't even polling on particular candidates' names. So, I mean, it's sort of the final insult to say, well, you didn't get a very good poll number. Well, no, nobody even asks about this person. That's why.
Or the public doesn't know early on, and they're really just going with party labels. And that definitely is going to advantage the candidates for the major parties.
So I've got time for one last question. And you said something really, really interesting during the break, which I hadn't really thought about. So obviously there was a little bit of a prejudice a few years ago with online polling when online polling was new. Since that time, we've kind of discovered that online polling can be done pretty effectively. And you made a really interesting point about how hard it is these days to poll congressional races by phone. And I hadn't thought at all about this, but explain that.
Right. So telephone polling and using a random digit dialing or randomly generated sample was always the gold standard, and in many ways it still is. But as cell phones have proliferated, and now we look at the country as about 70% cell phone only or cell phone primary household, cell phones are not tied to geographies the way landlines were. And so to poll in a congressional district is very, very expensive if you're going to use a telephone, because you have to do a lot of screening. You have to screen out, you know, there are phone numbers that are Connecticut area codes for people living in California or Wisconsin now. And so it really is almost impossible to do a quick and cost-effective congressional poll.
Right. It seems like also for ways that I have not even, for reasons that I haven't thought about at all, like the little thing that comes up in your screen, like my dentist in West Hartford always comes up as Stonington or something. Who knows why?
Right. Right. They could be assigned, you know, they have an office somewhere and that's where the primary line is. So, yeah. And voter registration lists don't typically have phone numbers with them or don't have current numbers. So even if you were going to go with registration-based sampling, that can be a challenge as well.
And I think the other prejudice that we've had for a long time is that phone is better. Phone is better. Human being is better. And there are a lot of reasons to have that. We've only got about a minute and a half left. But obviously, there's the so-called Bradley effect, or there are different names. But there's sometimes a sense that one human being polled is reluctant to say a thing to another person who's human being polling him, a thing that the person might be willing to tell an automated kind of robo call poll or an online poll.
Right. And so there is some evidence that people are less willing to share things that aren't socially acceptable or that they're uncomfortable with an interviewer. And the robo polls cannot include cell phones. So if you're going to look at that, I think your best bet is to compare a web poll, an online poll, to a telephone poll.
Yeah. All right. So that ends today's class in data science and opinion polling. I've had a lot of fun. I hope you had fun, too. We're so lucky to have Jennifer Dineen, who's available to us, program director of the graduate program in survey research at the UConn Department of Public Policy. I'll be in the wheelhouse on Wednesday morning if we have that Q poll. I mean, I'm no Jennifer Dineen, but I will do my best to try to pull this apart. I'll give you a little tip, though, something that she said earlier. If you're looking at the actual body of the poll instead of the news article about the poll, drop down to that question about whether the person is capable of changing his or her mind. Might change my mind. It's a really interesting question. And if there's a big number for any of the candidates on the Wednesday before the Tuesday of the election, that may be something worth thinking about. Anyway, just a little tip. You know, the crosstabs are fun. All right. Jennifer Dineen, thank you so much. And thanks to Scott Breedy. What an excellent, excellent debut as an episode producer.